summer school class in Long Beach last week, a question was read that nobody in the room could really answer. I think that you could answer it for us. The question was raised of, in the period of the late 1930s and early 40s, we had in the party industrial concentrations, and we had what was called industrial branches. And the comrades were wondering, were they like our present branches? What was their character? What were their activities? And would we have that type of branch again at some point?
Yeah, well, we had industrial, I think we had more industrial branches than the early 1930s when we did the league. There's one industrial branch that we have that I'm very familiar with, and that's the maritime branch in New York. But there, that is a unique, that it has a unique feature. It played a certain role that it would not play in another industrial branch. Now, because of the nature of the industry, because the members, many members are seen at any given time, and they may be in any one of 20 different ports, you see, not necessarily in the home port of New York. because it facilitated bringing contacts and recruits, contacts rather, and to maintain the connection with the party, we established an industrial branch in New York. Now, how did it operate? All the members of the branch were seamen, that is, maritime workers, seamen or longshoremen. Now, as I say, most of them at sea, on and off, not regularly, but usually. And therefore, in order to maintain a stable apparatus, we assigned to the branch about six or seven or eight comrades to man the branch apparatus. Literature agents and staff, with the exception of the organizer. That was 5%. That was me. Now, we had another industrial branch in the 30s, the teachers' branch. Now, there again, you see, let me explain how the method of function. Factions in the party are composed of all members working in a certain industry. Automatically, they become members of the faction. Well, let's take the auto faction. Or if you want to the steel faction. All members who are employed in steel are members of the steel faction. But the steel faction, the faction, is not a political unit in the party. The faction is a functional unit of the party. A functional unit. And therefore, it's subordinate to the appropriate political unit of the party. See? Faction does not set policy. Faction implements policy. A faction carries out policy decided by the political unit of the party. Now, sometimes, the party assigns comrades, political, that are active in the political, political unit to the faction, to maintain connection between the faction and the party, so that the political unit to the party to remain apprised of everything the faction is doing, especially if the faction is an important one. Like steel. Now, the steel fraction is a national fraction. It's not a local fraction, because they have steel comrades in plants all over the country. Therefore, the appropriate political unit to which the national fraction is subordinate is the political committee. The locals, the localities in the locals, the appropriate unit to which the local fraction, if there is a local fraction, is subordinate to the city committee, the local committee. Where there's only a branch, is the branch executive committee, and the branch. That's the political unit to which the fraction is subordinate. Now, the industrial branches function differently only in the sense they were combined. Both the functional aspect and the political aspect in the one unit. If it is a branch, it would be a political unit. It would carry out political policy and engage in activity in all areas of branch work. If it operated, it is fast, and every branch does. But it would concentrate. Activity in the particular area in which the fraction exists. If it's in the union, that would be the concentration. So, when the party, say, had a militant sub-campaign, that industrial branch would carry the militant sub-campaign into the industry in which it was active. In the steel would be in steel. It wouldn't go to shopping malls or other places where general branch comrades go and we sell the military. They would concentrate. When it had to have classes, it would concentrate on getting people out of the mill and out of the factory and out of the union. To attend those classes. It would concentrate on recruiting from the industry, on carrying out political work in that industry. You see? If it facilitated doing that, if it made it more productive, then an industrial branch would be justified. But it's only under unusual circumstances that it has been justified in the past. When we become a mass organization, then probably we'll have a lot of industrial branch, you see? Because it'll make our work much easier, facilitate, especially if we begin to have officials of union. And that's where they keep a sharp eye on the officials to see they don't go astray in a lot of temptation. And there's nothing like a good, strong faction, you see? Bringing down their neck will keep them alive. I know that, because I've had fractions bringing down my neck at times. But that is the only, it's not a problem for us, won't be a problem for us, but as far as I can see, unless things develop very, very rapidly for some time. Right now, the question is the fraction. The fraction is not a political unit, it's a functional unit. The government is the regular political unit, whatever that political unit happens to be. Now, in this particular case, it's the national. So, national policy cannot be set by the fraction, it must be set by the political committee. The fraction then carries out. But then, again, the practice has been to try as much as possible to maintain a very close link between the functional units of the party and the political units of the party so that you don't go off on tangents. See? So each knows what the other is doing and what the other intends, and you have a harmonious division of labor. That's what it amounts to, a harmonious division of labor within the party. Does that answer your question? I mean, do you want to need elaboration?
Yeah, there's one of the main habits of sectarians is to go into a union and launch some sort of caucus or another. And I wonder if you could give some of the distinguishing differences between that and the legitimate left wing as it develops within the union.
I don't know what you mean by one caucus or another. You're telling me that tactics in the union movement must be concrete. And I wouldn't have said an answer to an abstraction. Now, during the McCarthy period, or during the period of reaction, for example, we were opposed to entering into what we call power talk. That is, caucuses who are fighting for trade union posts and power. The conditions that are favorable for them. The only thing that these kind of caucuses constantly have to trim their programs, have to adapt themselves to the conditions and make their programs so palatable to the conservative workers on the job the result would be to foster an opportunistic trend or tendency in the policy. We were against that. We were against it at that time. We were against engaging in power talking. But at the same time, under very special circumstances, we were in power talking. As an example, we had a fight in the teachers' union, you see. But it wasn't one of these Friday night caucuses. It was very substantial. It was a caucus that controlled, if not a majority, at least a substantial minority of the union. And the head of the ticket was a person who used to be a member of the party. And it opened up again. Opened up for us the possibility of colonizing a substantial fraction of the trade union. And they're still active. I think there was an article that was in the Wilson this week, or last week, or week before, of one of our bigger comrades who colonizing the union just recently. Depending upon the time, condition, and then a number of other factors. Now, today, you don't have that problem in as acute form, although there still are some caucuses which are purely power caucuses that will get together and run on a program that's calculated to catch votes, you see. The possibility of putting the program into effect, even if they were elected. These are propaganda costs. It's not even propaganda costs. There's no objection under certain circumstances entering into a propaganda caucus, not one that aspires to take over control of the union, but promotes, say, the idea of independent working rights, the labor caucus. And many caucuses, these smaller caucuses, we would not enter unless we agreed with the program. And unless the program contains what we consider the most important political demand, the labor caucus, we would say no. No. Now, we get to this present caucus. This is both a power caucus, because obviously they ran for a candidate for president, and some of them have the illusion that the possibility of being elected. And a program, by and large, with which we agree. At least the central issue, even though it does not include our main political slogan of the Labour Party. See? On the basis of the past performance of this movement as a history, and of the knowledge we have of the role that the individuals play in the union, and their relation to the labor bureaucracy, and the program, we said this is a movement that we not only can, but must support. Not only must support it, we've got to get into deeper and deeper and deeper, so that we can influence the direction of the movement, so that the next election, in addition to the trade union program, that we will have enough influence to improve our political demands for the labor party. See? So there is no hard and fast rule. Today, I'd say today, the situation is such that the light should be given where before it was on the side of caution, and this time a little on the side of no freedom, the stern.
One of the peculiar things, can I digress for another moment?
One of the most peculiar things about this whole question of democracy in the Union is the role played by the government, the giving certainty. In order to get the Landrum-Griffin deal enacted in 1959, they had a sweetness, you see. They had to include the section guaranteeing the rank and file certain democratic rights to which they had been denied, that they knew that, you see, to make it more attractive and to reduce the amount of opposition in the ranks of labor to the enactment of Landrum-Griffin, which imposes some restrictive measures on the union movement. It has this whole section on democratic rights. See? They were all for that. It is unfortunate that there had to be the government to introduce this into the union movement. Because under the Landrum-Griffin law, the democratic rights section, that Sadlowski compelled them to have a re-election and became elected as the district elector. Remember, they stole the first election. There was nothing in the Constitution of the Civil War that they would prevent them from doing. And there was nothing in the composition of the bureaucracy of the Civil Union that would have permitted them any kind of an appeal to go through. No. Under Landrum-Griffin, the government was forced to intervene, mount an investigation, and declare the election that was held was dishonest, that they had stolen the election, and they ordered a new election. Now, this happened in the International Maritime Union also, where they had to have another election. It didn't turn out that way. The Kern was elected, and Kern's man, so that's how it was done. In the Irish Union also, do you think you could have an election under a court where an opposition candidate could be elected? That would be impossible. In any of these bureaucratized unions, you don't have chance number one in hell. But under Landrum-Griffin, for example, in election campaigns, they're supposed to turn over to an opposition candidate a list of all the members. If the trade union paper, the official trade union paper, runs electioneering propaganda for the official candidate, they've got to get the same rights as the opposing candidate. These are all in the Landrum-Griffin Act. Landrum-Griffin law. Now, the sectarians are against the Landrum-Griffin. Why? They're against interference by the government. Well, I say there's interference and interference. We're against interference by the government too. Now, we're against the cops. But we're not against the cops. You say disarm a gunman who's got a gun to make sure your government is demanding your what? The money is alive. Dialogue, you take from the 5% rejects from the gun business. 91% of it is unfavorable rejection. 1% is favorable to seize it with both hands and take advantage of it. Because you're dealing not with rank and file liberals, you're dealing with agents of imperialism. See, your bureaucratic child are agents of imperialism. They're not working. The worst mistake to make is identifying the bureaucracy as the union. That's what they would like to have us do. When they speak about us, they're not referring to the bureaucracy, but they identify themselves as the union. We are the union. That's definitely the answer. You always say you are not the union. You're an expression, you're a putrid on the body of the union politics. And we'll get rid of you. And then we'll have the union, the union that the workers can be proud of, that will fight for the workers instead of the oppressors and repressors.
In the mining industry, and also people have some of the
just let me answer that question, because I can't remember that much.
I don't know what the numbers of that are. I don't know whether they have one or 50. I don't know. And if I didn't know, I probably wouldn't tell you. It doesn't make any difference. I don't see what difference. Even if we didn't have a single number, our policy would not be any different.
That we have, that's the question. It's not what we have. I know that's a difference.
It's what we have or what we had. I said, even at the beginning, when we gave the Cleveland to Walter Miller, if we didn't have a single number, we would have been in trouble.
I don't mean it all in the last decade. I mean, in the 30s and 40s, did we have any significant chunk in the miners in the
I don't think so. I don't think we had anything since the 1920s. I can't remember when there was a split in the United Mine Workers Union and the formation of the Progressive Miners Union. I know Cam was active in Progressive Mine Workers Union. Huh? 1924 was the split. Now, subsequent to that, in the modern time, and after 30, I don't know. Frankly, I don't know, Conrad. I don't know what we have in the Miners Union. I don't think we ever had very much, if we had anything at all. I don't think we had very much in the Miners Union. It wasn't the kind of occupation that attracted them up to draw our people out of the city. We were mostly in the city. And the mining usually was in real life. I don't know. Fine. Now, what is your present question?
Some people have been throwing around little bits of knowledge they have about the composition of the party. During the 40s, there was a large influx at one point of a good proportion of black workers into the Socialist Workers Party, at least in the latter part of the 1940s. Well, I'm not sure about that.
I'm sure because I was there.
Right. But during the later part of the 40s?
1946, 45.
Could you give any statistics about what the composition, what percentage of the total party was black at the peak of that period? And also, do you have any comment on the phenomenon of all black branches of the SAC, which existed in several places according to one source? But I assume that there were all black branches at one time somewhere. Do you have any comments on that?
But if there are, I don't know about them. And I don't know what this source is. I didn't know of a branch in Harlem, but it was not an all-white branch. It was 95%. But not an all-white branch.
Do you have any comments on the activities?
On the what?
On the activities of the Harlem branch?
Yes, yes. Is that your question? That's your question.
And in addition, what percentage of the total party was?
Now, as to the percentage of in the party at that period, I don't know. And I remember it was very good statistics. I don't have a number of tries to fix those things in my mind. Those are not important. I do remember the Harlem branch, because I was organizing and we were going to establish the Harlem branch. Along with six or seven or eight other branches. It was one of those periods when the party was going through a period of rapid expansion, and we began to, as you have been doing recently, we began to establish multi-branch locals. It was 1945-46. Remember, during the period of the war, we had a drawback into the one headquarters at 116. We had one branch. Then when we began to expand, we began to establish multiple branches. One of the branches was in Harlem. Now, how did we go about doing this? First, we assigned a group of comrades as an organizing committee, and we set them up to Harlem. Among them were two blacks and three whites. And among them, this may surprise you, was one called Herbert Hill, who is now
the labor secretary of the NAACP, isn't he? Yes.
Labor secretary. Yes. He utilized our experience in Harlem as a springboard to become labor secretary of the NAACP. He's not black, by the way, although he passes as black. He's a Brooklyn boy. three whites and two blacks, and we rented a place up there. One night a week to hold classes, and then we took to the street corner. Now, Harlem was different in 1946 than it was later. Later, it was difficult for whites to appear in Harlem. At a later period, when especially during the intense growth of black nationalism. But in this period, it was not. Whites could function up in Harlem without any discolor at all, and so we used to hold street corner meetings. And in the street corner meetings, among the general agitation, we'd invite people up to attend our classes that we were holding, which was on 116th Street, and some of them came. Now, we went private. We had decided, you know, during the war, and in the 1930s, we had a rule in the park. Now we have provision.
Is that what they call it?
Provisional membership. Then we have probational membership. That is, a member would join the party, but the member would be on probation for a period of 6 months, roughly, 2 or 6 months, in which the member would have voice but no vote. And that was a carryover from the old Communist Party days when the Communist Party was underground, you see. And everybody had to be scrutinized very carefully, had to be tested, retested, before they could finally assume the obligation of party membership. And we sat down and said, this decision must be quite an obstacle. This is 1945-46, and there was a surging mass movement. It was the biggest strike wave in history. So we decided to drop the whole thing. From now on, if the person we recruit is black, if the person we recruit is a worker, we don't have any obstacle course for this person to jump over before they consider themselves a member. We've got to make them a full first-class member right from the start. And so we began to recruit members right off in Chicon, yes, in Harlem. And we recruited a lot of them. Black Middleton. And said, yeah, I agree with that, I'll join the party. Now, they, most of the people we recruited didn't have our understanding of the party. Understanding of the party came from the experience of the Democratic Party, usually, or the Republican Party. And joining them, being a member of the party meant that they voted, and when election time came around, they voted for this party and this enemy, and they went into election booth. So it was our task to take them and educate them into a different kind of party. That's what we tried to do. And you know, we had 100 members in the Harlem branch. In a very short time. I think there are about 10 white and about 9 black members in the Harlem branch in 1946. Yes. I recall one of the major activities then was about big campaign against police brutality. And this person here who had to get together, he saw people on the street. He certainly was a talker. He was one of the main speakers at the street corner meeting for the NAACP. He had the NAACP campaign against police brutality, in which we threw our whole forces, but we do when we're serious about any campaign. Out of this, we recruited as many members. Now, it didn't last very long. It lasted until the Cold War and the beginning of the reaction. And then we began to lose members. We began to lose members not only in Harlem, but all over. Members who had never really been assimilated, never really been educated. We didn't have the time, there wasn't the time. In a short period of less than a year, you can't make revolutionary socialists, you see, out of the raw materials that they were recruiting. And as the reaction grew, so did the loss of members. And this continued, you know, it continued through the period of McCarthyism. And then it became a question of just hanging on. And then we found it necessary, all these branches that we set up, including the Harlem branch, to liquidate these branches and bring them all back into the center, into one branch. We've gone through this process several times. Remember, we established a branch in the Bronx, we have two branches in Brooklyn, we have a branch in Queens, we have branches all over the place. But you cannot build in the period of political reaction. And that's what we went through. But it wasn't until the Montgomery bus boycott that the party began to revive, began to recruit. And then came the Cuban Revolution. And then came the big tournament of people on the campus, these wonderful young comrades, young men and women on the campus, and then the Vietnam War. Although we never did change our orientation towards proletarian orientation, towards the Union, we try to take advantage of a radicalization wherever it occurs. And so we did a little detour, that's all. We went where the radicals were, and we recruited, and we made progress. And now, I remember the convention when the party came to the conclusion that they didn't turn. That is all the working class were beginning to move. They were beginning to be ferment. There's only discontent, dissatisfaction. Beginning to be signs of movement, where previously there had been just apathy and passivity. They said it's time for us to make the turn, to begin to pay more attention, to seek out opportunities, not to abandon any of the areas of struggle which remain as viable today, more so than ever before, but to take advantage from the very beginning of any movement which we can utilize to cement what has been the goal of the revolutionary socialists from the very beginning, is to bring all these sectors to fruition at the same time. Then you've got a revolutionary situation. Then you can talk about a revolution, you can talk about a social revolution. When the blacks and the women and the Chicano and the gays and the other minorities and the unions and the working class unorganized, as well as organized, when they all develop to the point of becoming part of a harmonious revolutionary current, they will sweep everything. No force on earth will stop it. And that's what we are now engaged in our present journey, you see, to supplement the cadre, the core that we've gathered together in the past several decades, since the Montgomery of 45, since the enormous uprising of Afro-Americans in the South that smashed the Jim Crow system. That's what we've been working for. And we think we're beginning to see that. You see, the Sadowski movement comes along with this. You know, you can't quarrel with history. Pardon my references to Terrence, I can't help it, you know. That's what we spend their whole lives doing, quarreling with history. Who could possibly have conceived that a John L. Lewis, one of the most reactionaries, yeah, he was of the royal type, a gangster, a thug, would become head of the CIA. If you had even suggested that it was a straitjacket, you would have been thrown into a booby hatch. Anybody would even think that John L. Lewis would become head of the most progressive union movement that this country has ever seen. But that's what happened. That's what history was ever doing. So what were you going to do? Complain about history? Say, well, maybe it would have been better with Jim Can. Yes, clearly better with Jim Can. But it wasn't Jim Cannon's time, it was John L. Lewis' time. And Sidney Hillman. And David Kuczynski. And Roy Howard. And the rest of them. The same with the Sadowski movement. It's the movement that brought Sadowski up to the top. He was the one that represented up to the book present time. But he represented only insofar as he continues to act in accordance with the dynamic of the movement. And it's the dynamic of the movement that we're concerned with. That's why we say there's a turn. There's a turn in the consciousness of the American working class. Now, up to now, the overt manifestation politically has been one of rejection, of rejecting things as they are. a fewer and fewer people voted in the election. They have the consciousness of, when is the point yet where they seek a positive alternative, where they say, well, you've got to have something else, something more radical. The Socialist Workers' Party, I hear their candidates. I see their young people. They're out fighting all the time. Maybe that's the cause. Those are the people that we're going to need. The movement thus far on the political arena has been of a negative sort. That is, a rejection of what is and not yet an acceptance of what should be, what ought to be, what this country is capable of being. You see, but the worst thing is to become impatient. That is absolutely the worst thing. To become impatient, but if it doesn't help, and it just wrecks the any promising movement. Things are going our way. All we got to do is keep the old rules in the minds from you. Don't ask too much because you won't get too much. Don't expect any medal of women. I didn't get one. I've been 40 years at it. I never even got a medal of cannon, by the way. But that's not what we're after. We're after Pharrell. We're after a new world. And that's something worth living and fighting for. There we go.
Thank you.